to the second part of QFT 3. So I'll be lecturing Wednesday to Friday this week and Wednesday to Friday next week. And I'll be talking about two different subjects. This week, I will discuss anomalies, and next week, instantons. And the other four lectures, Gong will be telling you about CFT in two dimensions. So for the next three lectures, our focus will be anomalies. And I've already seen Noether's theorem at least three times this year. It was one of the first things we discussed in QFT 1. And it's going to be central to our discussion of anomalies. And I'm here to tell you that Noether's theorem is a lie. It's simply not true quantum mechanically. Well, sometimes it works, but often it doesn't. So our many derivations we saw were all relying entirely on classical physics. So of course it works classically. And sometimes quantum mechanically. And the focus of the next three lectures is going to be those times when it doesn't work, when we include quantum mechanical effects. So what an anomaly is, Jaume discussed this a little bit on in his final lecture, but we'll go into more details up in the next three lectures. What an anomaly is, so an anomaly is a quantum effect that spoils a classical symmetry. And we'll see from a variety of perspectives how and why this occurs. So for instance, Today we're going to examine a simple model, make a number of approximations just to simplify the discussion that aren't strictly necessary to derive it. And tomorrow we'll derive things more carefully from two different perspectives. So we'll look at the path integral, our functional integral perspective tomorrow. And so classical symmetry is a symmetry of the action. But if we're discussing quantum mechanics in the functional integral perspective, we also have a measure. And that measure is not always invariant under the symmetries. And so an anomaly can arise when classical action is invariant, but the measure is not. We'll also see that anomalies can arise. We compute correlation functions of conserved currents, and we'll be able to show using perturbation theory, that it's not always possible for the divergences of those correlation functions to vanish, like you'd expect if the symmetry was respected in the full quantum theory. So anomalies have both IR and UV aspects. So they can be observed in the IR. And while I won't discuss this very much, for those of you who are familiar with the standard model, there's a symmetry that forbids the classical symmetry that forbids the decay of the neutral pion to photons. Observationally, it's observed to that decay is observed to happen, neutral pion to two photons, and you can compute that decay rate. That decay rate is entirely determined by the anomaly. So we can compute the anomaly of that symmetry, and that determines the decay rate of the neutral pion to two photons. I'm not going to focus very much on phenomenological applications, but just the important point is that although much of our discussion is going to be focused on what's going on in the UV, anomalies can be observed with low energy experiments, and there's a number of other examples that where anomalies are essential in predicting experimental results. And so what we'll often be discussing, what we'll discuss a bit today and more tomorrow, is that we can think of anomaly as arising when it's impossible. When it's impossible to find a UV regulator that respects all the symmetries. And often we're forced to choose between respecting a gauge symmetry and a global symmetry. Gauge symmetries are clearly more important to our quantum theory. They're connected to things like renormalizability and unitarity. So if we can't find a regulator that respects all the symmetries, we're going to choose one that respects our gauge symmetry and breaks a global symmetry. And we'll see in today's simple example, we'll see how this works, and in tutorial tomorrow we'll examine this point in more detail. So we're going over the next few lectures. So today we're going to examine in more detail and from a different perspective massless QED in two dimensions. You had a homework problem that looked at some aspects of the chiral anomaly in this theory. We'll re-examine this. Okay. And so the chiral anomaly is also referred to as the axial anomaly, and I'll use these two terms interchangeably. It's also sometimes referred to as the ABJ anomaly after its discoverers, Adler, Bell, and Jeku. Some of the references will use this terminology, but these all mean the same thing. Then tomorrow, we will derive the chiral anomaly. Using functional integrals. And in tutorial tomorrow, we'll derive it using Feynman diagrams. These two different derivations will illustrate different aspects of the anomaly. And then on Friday, we'll discuss gauge anomalies. So we have a non-abelian gauge theory. Sometimes, depending on what matter we include and couple to those non-abelian gauge fields, sometimes the gauge symmetry itself becomes anomalous, where there's no choice about whether to break that symmetry or another symmetry. or certain types of chiral fermions can break age symmetry, which is unlike the chiral anomaly, which can explain experiments. Gauge anomaly is a terrible thing. It destroys the consistency of the theory. And so demanding that the gauge anomalies vanish or cancel will put interesting constraints on the types of matter we're allowed to couple in the non-abelian gauge theory. So that's where we're going over the next few lectures. And today, so first, we'll discuss some classical aspects of the Schwinger model, which is massless 2D QED. And then we'll discuss the chiral anomaly. And illustrate some of these general properties of anomalies. Any questions so far? Okay. So the first part of today's lecture, I will just review some classical aspects of the Schwinger model and discuss gauge fixing. So our goal today is just going to be to define one of the simplest roots of the anomaly. We'll consider more general derivations tomorrow. I didn't already mention it. Lecture notes have been posted on the wiki. They'll be updated daily. So, okay. The Schwinger model is massless 2D QED. And what we're going to be interested in is the chiral anomaly in this theory. So, first, I'd just like you to recall some facts about free Dirac spinner in four dimensions from QFT1. So the Lagrangian, just the familiar Dirac Lagrangian, and the mass is zero. Then this theory has lots of symmetries, but two that will be relevant for us. It has a vector symmetry under which the fermion field gets a phase. Call this the vector symmetry. One B. It also has an axial symmetry, is the same, except we put a gamma 5 in the exponent. And Noether's theorem tells us that each of these symmetries has a corresponding conserved current. Which you derived in QFT1. And I'll just call. That tells us that the divergence of the vector current, which I will just denote as a J with no subscript that will indicate the vector current. So Noether's theorem tells us that these currents are conserved where J mu is just psi bar gamma mu psi. And similarly, the axial current, according to Noether's theorem, is also conserved. And I will denote the axial current as a J mu 5. And the same as the vector current, just with an extra gamma 5. So what we're going to show is that, well, we have a choice between which of these equations is true in the quantum theory. And we want to choose this one because this one is connected with the gauge invariance of the theory. So this is not going to be true in the quantum theory. So this is hopefully all familiar to you from QFT1. And basically nothing I've written on this board depends on the fact that we're in 4D. It also works in 2D. The only difference in 2D is the gamma matrices are smaller. Yes, and one more point is that this also works in QED in four dimensions because the gauge field is neutral under both of these symmetries. So no part of this derivation will change in QED. And everything on this board also works in 2D. So in 2D, the Schwinger model that we're going to study, it looks exactly the same as in 4D. The difference is that our gamma matrices should satisfy the usual anti-commutation relations, where the metric is now just 2x2 matrix with entries 1 and minus 1. And so we can satisfy these anti-commutation relations. There's many ways to do that. Convenient basis for us to choose is the chiral basis. So we will work in the chiral basis for the remainder of the lecture. And in the chiral basis, in 2D, you can choose gamma 0 to be sigma 2. And gamma 1, I sigma 1. And then gamma 5 will just be the product gamma 0, gamma 1, which is just sigma 3. And so in this basis, we can write our fermion fields in terms of two components. We'll call psi plus and psi minus. So these will be basically the analogs of the left and right-handed components of a Dirac fermion in 4D. And these behave basically the same way. So we act at gamma 5 on psi. We see here that this just gives us plus psi plus and minus psi minus. And so we can also define projection operators, p plus and minus, or p right or left, which are just take the same form that you're used to, 1 plus or minus gamma 5 over 2. And if we act with gamma 5 on p plus or minus psi, we just get plus or minus p plus or minus psi. So in this basis, we can expand out the fermion kinetic term. And we just write out the matrix components, do the matrix multiplication. What we'll get is psi dagger plus I d0 plus d1 psi plus. Plus psi dagger minus I d0 minus d1 psi minus. So we see that there is no mixing of psi plus and psi minus, no direct mixing at least. And so that tells us that the number currents for psi plus and minus are separately conserved. Which means that the divergence of psi plus minus and mu psi plus minus is zero. And of course, we should expect this. This is just a linear we're just taking a linear combination of our vector and axial currents. So we have two different, in this theory, we've got particles of two different chiralities, and classically, the number of each type should be separately conserved. And again, we'll see that that's not going to be true in the quantum theory. Okay, so when we do quantize this theory, we're going to make a number of approximations to simplify our derivation. And what we're going to do is we're going to treat the fermion fields quantum mechanically, but we're going to treat the gauge fields just as some classical fixed background fields. So what we'll need in order to do that are the equations of motion for the free fermions. And if we just starting from our Dirac Lagrangian, just derive the equations of motion in this chiral basis, what we get is that combination of derivatives acting on psi plus and minus has to be zero. And this is a simple equation to solve. Solutions are just waves moving to the right or left, the speed of light. So the left moving are the minus one, psi minus, and the right moving our plus. So there's one complication about the Schwinger model, and that is that in two dimensions, the Coulomb potential grows linearly. Which means if we were examining the Schwinger model in two-dimensional Minkowski space, we'd have, for no matter what value we chose for the coupling, the gauge coupling at some energy scale, the theory would eventually become strongly coupled at low energies. We separated two charges, the potential energy between them would grow and grow, and eventually become energetically favorable to pop out a pair of particle-antiparticle pair, just like in QCD in four dimensions. So this theory confines if we're in infinite space. But we can avoid this problem just by compactifying our theory on a circle. So we compactify in a circle. With circumference. L. And L is small enough, in particular, if E naught L is much less than 1, then we can avoid this problem. So the basically the particles can never get far enough away from each other that it would be advantageous to create an extra particle antiparticle pair. And so remember we're in 2D here, so the gauge coupling is dimensionful. We can see that just by looking at the dimensions of our fields. So the this is our one-term interaction. This should have dimension 2. These contain derivatives, which have dimension 1. So our fermion fields have dimension 1/2. And the gauge field has to have the same dimension as the derivative. Which tells us, if we look at our gauge kinetic term, which is where I put the gauge coupling, that should also have dimension 2. It's got two derivatives, two gauge fields. So it's got dimension 4 divided by e squared and the dimension. So that tells us the dimension of e has to be 1. So this is compactified in a small enough circle so that we don't have to deal with strong coupling. And we'll want to deal with a really small coupling, so eventually we're going to want to, for simplicity, just ignore the Coulomb interaction. Okay, so
A to be 1 dimension?
Why is A dimension 1? So contained in this term So we've got.
Is F your new term for assumptions?
Your question is about the dimension of A or dimension of E?
Dimension of A.
Dimension of A. So if we look at at fermion kinetic term. So if we expand this out, this is psi bar I gamma mu
okay.
E naught plus I d mu psi a mu psi. So for these, for the psi d psi term to have the same dimensions as the psi a term, a has to have dimension one. Okay. So the last thing we're going to do in the classical theory before we move on to the quantum theory is we're going to gauge fix. It's just going to simplify our discussion later. It's not necessary. We could do everything here in a gauge invariant way, and tomorrow we will, but it will simplify our discussion. So we're going to see how much, or we're going to try to gauge fix this theory as much as we can. So since we're dealing with a theory on a circle, we can expand the gauge field in terms of Fourier components. And I'll just write the Fourier expansion like this. And so we'll assume we're imposing periodic boundary conditions on A. So we get a sign here. So just Fourier expanding A. And this can have general time dependence, but we know it has to be periodic. So Fourier expansion should look like this. Under gauge transformation, A mu goes to A mu plus the derivative of some gauge transformation parameter A. And if we choose A of T and X to be sum, where n is not zero, of L over 2 pi n times A1 of T sine of 2 pi n over Lx, we can eliminate the spatial dependence of A1. So if we just take a derivative of this, we'll get a factor of 2 pi n over L that'll cancel this prefactor off, and that will eliminate the spatial dependence of A1. We can't do this for both components at once, but we can at least get rid of the spatial dependence in A1. This tells us we can set A1, which before we gauge fix depends on both T and X, and set this just to be a constant. So this doesn't work for n equals 0, so we can't set that constant to 0. We can just set it to be some time dependent but spatially constant field. We can do better than this, though, because here we only dealt with only considered gauge transformation parameters that were periodic. That's not necessary. All that we care about is that our gauge field is periodic. And we can choose alpha to be 2 pi n over L. This is a so-called large gauge transformation. that's not periodic, but it does respect the periodicity of the gauge field, which is what we care about. And by doing these types of gauge transformations, we see that A1 plus 2 pi n over L are all gauge equivalent. In other words, A1 lives on a circle. Of circumference two pi over L. And this is essentially the best we can do. We can't eliminate a constant A1 because the exponential of the integral over the gauge fields on a circle is a gauge invariant Wilson loop, which we can't change the value of that by doing gauge transformation. So this will be enough and will simplify our discussion of the quantum theory. We can make a gauge choice so that A1 is a constant, lives on a circle of circumference 2 pi over L. Any questions on the classical theory before we move on to the fun? Katerina?
Just to see if I understood, this Schrödinger model was first a global symmetry, but because of this problem of growing global potential, it will compactify to something local? Yes.
So our space time, we're compactifying the spatial dimension. So we are considering so this is still our Lagrangian. Our symmetries are the same symmetries as before. We're just considering this theory instead of on two-dimensional Minkowski space, considering it on the spatial direction as a circle.
Here you wrote in QED 4D we have mu going to mu. Does that mean that alpha is just some constant that means it doesn't depend on?
So that was the under the vector and axial symmetry.
Yeah.
The gauge field does not transform. That's still true. Nothing. All the in the classical theory, all the equations on this board are work in either, except for this part, work in either 2D or 4D. They work in Minkowski space or on a compactified space. So nothing on that board depends on the global properties of our space-time. So what we're compactifying here is space. And if we compactify in space, that tells us that, the physically distinct values of A1 also live on a circle. We didn't input that was an output. But our input was that space is a circle instead of a line. Yes?
I'm a bit confused. So if you're compactifying, why does A look like it has Dirichlet boundary conditions?
We are proposing the boundary conditions that A of 0 is the same as A of L.
Yeah, but you're also imposing that A of 0 is 0.
N can be 0 here.
What?
There's an N equals 0 term.
Oh, I see. I see.
Here N is anything. Here N can't be 0. I guess this expression doesn't make sense. Okay. Jessica, did you have a
So is the A1 completely constant, or is it still a function of time?
It's still a function of time. Okay. So.
Wait, sorry.
Yes.
You said N can be 0.
In this equation, yes.
Yeah, then you have sine of 0.
Maybe we can add a constant term here.
Is that enough? Okay, right, sure.
Okay. So we're going to make a number of approximations and assumptions that are not strictly necessary, but we'll just simplify the derivation. And so we're going to work in the adiabatic approximation. So we're going to assume A1 is external. Function of time only in our choice of gauge and slowly varying. You could avoid this approximation because the fermionic frequencies you can show are much larger than the photon frequencies, assuming the circle is small enough. We'll just make this assumption. And furthermore, we're going to set A0 to 0. So A0 is basically responsible for the Coulomb interaction. And since our circle is small enough and our coupling is weak enough, the Coulomb interaction is always going to be weak. And we could treat it as a perturbation, but it will be unimportant at leading order. So these are just inputs. We're going to treat those as classical background fields. And with these, assumptions, the Dirac equation becomes D0 plus gamma 5 E1 minus I A1 psi, where I've just multiplied by minus I gamma 0, put it, go from this form to this form, and set A0 to 0. Okay, so this is the equation we want to solve. And the stationary state wave functions should look like this, exponential of minus I en times t times psi n of x. And we impose periodic boundary conditions on psi. That tells us that psi n should be like the exponential of 2i I n x over L. And if we plug this back into the Dirac equation. A few lines of algebra just show us that these tell us that the left and right movers, or the psi plus and psi minus, have different energies. And those energies are given by plus or minus 2 pi n over L minus or plus A1. So we know the energies, so we know the spectrum of the theory. And it'll be useful to think about what the ground state looks like in the Dirac C picture. So the allowed energies for A1 equal to 0, the allowed energies. So the right movers have E equals P, so the allowed energies are just equally spaced. All along a line with unit slope that passes through the origin. So this is what the right moving spectrum looks like. The psi plus. And the left moving spectrum looks the same, just with opposite slope, equally spaced energy levels. And in the Dirac C picture, all of the in the ground state, all of the negative energy and zero energy states are filled. And all the positive energy states are empty. So this is the Dirac C picture for the ground state with A1 equal to 0. So now we can ask what would happen if we adiabatically increased A1 from 0 to 2 pi over L. So we know those are equivalent states, but what happens during that transition. So if we adiabatically, so here's a picture of the ground state. We adiabatically increase A1 from 0 to pi over L. Several things will happen. So one is that the occupation numbers will be unchanged. It's an adiabatic increase, so there should be no change in occupation numbers. The spectrum is mapped to itself. So if we take A1 from 0 to 2 pi over L, the difference between the energy levels is 2 pi over L, so we're mapping the spectrum to itself. So what's going to happen is just the left moving particles will all shift up. So under this change, the left moving particles will move up. And we'll have a new field state. A1 equal 2 pi L. And the right moving particles will all move down. And so we'll have a new empty state. And so that means what we've got is, so this adiabatic change took us from the ground state with no particles and no antiparticles to a state with one left moving particle and one right moving antiparticle. Minus particle. Antiparticle. And so the left movers and the right movers have the same electric charge. So electric charge is unchanged. But the axial charge will be changed. So Q is unchanged. But if we assign Q5 equals 1 for the plus states and plus particles, and Q5 equals minus 1 for the minus particles, then minus antiparticle, plus antiparticle will also have Q5 equals minus 1, so the net change and the axial charge is minus 2. It's not 0. So axial charge is not conserved, which means the axial current can't be conserved either. So this is the anomaly. Our symmetry is broken.
N is positive, right?
Sorry?
N is positive, right?
N is positive or negative. So here we're working the Dirac C picture. So if we have a empty negative energy state, we can interpret that as a positive energy antiparticle.
I don't understand the shifting of the little circles, because if you take A1 is equal to plus blah blah, the straight line should just go up and down. Why the straight line doesn't move?
So what we're plotting here is the energy versus momentum. So the energy just moves straight up or down, but I have two separate diagrams just to distinguish the left movers versus the right movers. So the energy of the right movers moves down when we increase A1 because of the minus sign, and the energy of the left movers moves up when we increase A1. So the energy moves up, and they're still, all of the left and right movers, states are always moving at the speed of light. So E is always equal to plus or minus P. These diagrams, E versus P.
E is always plus or minus P?
Yes. Okay. We have massless particles. That follows just from our free Fermion equation of motion. Okay, so we know that the axial charge changes, and we can use what we've done so far to figure out what the correct classically, we know that the divergence of the axial current is zero. That equation can't be right if the axial charge changes, but we can use what we've done so far to figure out the correct version of the that conservation equation. So we could imagine, instead of changing A1 from 0 to 2 pi over L, we could change it from 0 to 4 pi over L. Then we'd shift all our states up by 2. And we'd have twice the change in A1, twice the change in the axial charge. So that tells us that the change in the axial charge has to be proportional to the change in A1. And we can use these known values to figure out the constant of proportionality. So we know delta Q 5 has to be proportional to delta A1. If delta A1 is 2 pi over L, delta Q is minus 2, so the constant of proportionality has to be minus L over pi. And if we divide this equation by delta T, take delta T to 0, we get that Q5 dot minus L over pi A1 dot. And of course, the axial charge is just the integral of the zeroth component of the axial current. And you can also write L times A1 as an integral. So L times A1, so L is just the integral over space of a constant. So our space is a circle of circumference L. And we know A1 is a spatial constant. And we can also write A1 in the following manner. We can write it as epsilon 0 mu A mu. If mu is 0, we just get 0 here. So this is just A1. And the integral dx gets us L. So putting these equations together, this equation is just the zeroth component, mu equals 0 term of the divergence of the axial current. And the right-hand side is just 1 over pi epsilon mu nu f mu nu. And the this is the and the other term that's missing from here is 0, because we just set a 0 to 0. This equation with A0 equals to 0 is equivalent to this equation. And this is, in fact, the correct quantum mechanical version of the conservation equation. And this is known as the anomalous non-conservation equation.
Above the box come from? L A1?
OK, so epsilon 0 mu A mu. If we take mu equals 0, we have an epsilon 0, 0, which is 0. So epsilon 0, 1, A1 is the same as A1. And the integral over space is just L, because this in our gauge, A1 is a spatial constant, and we're working on a circle of circumference L. Okay. So just about out of time, but I want to make one important comment. So what we did here implicitly assumed a UV regularization. All of our discussion was about what was going on in the IR near zero energy. But we implicitly assumed when I said that the charge was unchanged after this adiabatic increase in A1 and the axial current was changed, we implicitly assumed some UV cutoff. So we assumed that in order to say that the charge is zero, well, we're talking about an infinite number of states. So in order to make that statement precise, we need to have some cutoff and see what happens when I eliminate the cutoff. We were assuming that the cutoff was something like this, where whenever a state left below the cutoff over here, another state crossed the cutoff over here. So we could imagine doing something different, where the crossing of these states through our UV cutoff didn't occur at the same value of A1 for the left and right movers. In that case, we chose a cutoff that where, say, instead of just some fixed cutoff, maybe the right movers, the cutoff depended on A1. And we didn't let any states enter over here when they left over there. In that case, the charge could be, the electric charge could change. So these statements that Q is unchanged and Q5 is changed depends on our UV cutoff. This seems like a natural one, but it's not the only possible UV cutoff we could make. And well, tomorrow we'll see some examples where it's not clear what type of UV cutoff we want to make. And a priori, and what we'll have to do is we'll have to pick a UV regularization scheme that leaves our vector currents conserved. We'll examine this in more detail. Mark, yes.
It seems to me like that we are still working on the, like, there's no Q of T here. I can't see any quantization thing. It's still like Q quantum mechanics.
That's right. I've simplified things as much as possible. We were solving the Dirac equation, so in that sense, we're doing Q of T. But we will tomorrow's approaches will be very much like the approaches you're used to. We'll in lecture go through a path functional integral version and derive essentially the same results in four dimensions. So that will look very familiar to you from 52. And then in the tutorial, we'll go through a Feynman diagram derivation of the same thing. But just want to present the simplest possible context first. Any other questions? See you tomorrow.